T-minus 10, 9, 8,
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. One summer night back in 1981, a scruffy group of New York rock and roll fans and freshly minted TV executives took a bus across the Hudson River to New Jersey to celebrate the launch of their new cable channel.
Ladies and gentlemen, rock and roll.
Why Jersey? Well, 30 years ago, no one carried MTV in New York City. And that may have been a blessing in disguise, because the first broadcast was a mess.
It was a total unmitigated disaster. We also had done stereo TV for the first time. But most of the studios had been set up for mono. So listening in stereo sounds fine. You listen in mono, which 99.9% of the people did, and suddenly either it wasn't there, it sounded like this. And everything that could have gone wrong did go wrong. Probably one of the worst nights of my life. Everybody else is having a party and celebrating.
Right.
I'm having a heart attack.
That is one of MTV's founders, Bob Pittman. He's one of 400 people interviewed for I Want My MTV. It's an oral history assembled by Rob Tannenbaum and Craig Marks, now out in paperback. MTV would go on to shape pop culture in lots of ways, transforming not just the music industry, but TV and movies. When the channel was founded, according to Craig Marks,
people didn't even know what music videos were. So you're going to kind of launch a whole, you know, back then maybe like, what, a $30 million network based on this thing that no one's really ever seen. It's counterintuitive, to say the least.
And the big tactical achievement that they did early on was the I Want My MTV campaign.
That's
that
right.
Got those local people to say, I guess we got to put it on.
It's a brilliant, you know, one of the more brilliant advertising campaigns ever, in that it went around these gatekeepers and it roped in rock stars who, you know, usually get a lot of money for that kind of stuff. And this was all done for nothing.
People like Mick Jagger.
Mick Jagger, Pete Townsend, the Police. I mean, what it did, it actually got people to go ahead and call their local cable operators, like Sting told you to call your local cable company and demand your MTV. And that's what people actually did.
America, demand your MTV. I want my MTV.
I want my MTV.
I want my MTV.
MTV, music, television, video, music, 24 hours a day, and it's stereo.
Say, I want my MTV!
So, do you remember the first time you ever watched MTV?
I do. I was selling pots and pans door to door as a summer job in college, and I was in the Philadelphia area, and I went to a house and was let in the door, and they were watching television, and I saw this music video, and I was like, what the heck is this? And it was MTV, and I'd never heard of it and didn't have cable where I lived, but that's how I found it.
It sort of, among other things, brought the music business back to life, didn't it?
Sure. Yeah. The music business had been suffering very badly. It was the post-disco doldrums, and disco really was a bubble economy for the music biz. And so that was the late 70s, early 80s, and it was in real dire straits. And also in some ways, classic rock radio, which was the dominant rock radio form, was very conservative and very staid, and was very hard to get new music played. And the lifeblood of the record industry is getting new bands played. So MTV would basically play any video from anyone who was signed to a record company, as long as you were white, it turned out. And so they did. And so that's how all these new British bands, such as the Stray Cats, who sort of got their start in London, and Duran Duran. And
so everything we know as 80s music.
Right. Just was kind of a byproduct of this weird economy in the music video industry, where these bands loved the kind of theatrical nature of videos, and they were really early to adapt them. And then MTV had really no choice but to play them, because they had nothing else.
Yeah. Well, and then once it started working, the central genius business idea, which is to say, oh, the record industry will pay for our content and we'll make all the money.
Right. It's the greatest thing, that it's the internet all over again. We'll just take your content for free. MTV was like a national radio station that played a Michael Jackson song next to a Duran Duran song next to a Guns N' Roses song. And that was really hard to find. That didn't exist in radio, and I think that's pretty profound that they were able to do that.
That's interesting. So we had the free-form FM DJs of the late 60s and 70s who did a version of that. But this, you're saying, did it again, putting really unlike kinds of music side by side.
Right, exactly. And an interesting thing in the book is there's a chapter about when MTV decided to finally play a black artist in for real, which was Michael Jackson in the Billie Jean video. And they didn't really want to play it, and they deny that still to this day, but essentially they had their hand forced. CBS was going to pull all their videos. So they played the video, and it became a pretty good-sized hit, and then Beat It followed that and became a bigger hit, and then Thriller became essentially the most important video of all time, music video. And immediately MTV started playing this video all the time. So they went from, in 1 week, we're not going to play black artists to we're going to play Michael Jackson and Prince every minute of the day.
But surely they didn't say we can't play black musicians.
No, but they did. The people who founded MTV, especially from the programming end of it, were all radio people. And they thought that based on their radio experience, the only music to play for that audience was rock music. And then later on, almost the same way they played Thriller and Michael Jackson, they kind of accidentally stumbled upon playing hip-hop by starting this show called Yo MTV Raps.
In 1988.
Right, which was only supposed to be on at Saturday at 2 in the morning and all of a sudden brought in all these crazy rating numbers. And then in the MTV fashion, the next thing you know, it's on every day at 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
One of my producers who grew up in the Great Plains during that era said that was his godsend. That made him feel connected to culture beyond Wichita.
Yeah, absolutely. When we spoke to Jazzy Jeff, he said when MTV would play their videos, he would go home to Philadelphia for like a summer barbecue and everyone would have the same haircut that he did in the video. And there was no other way that they would know about that. That was the way that you found out if you were in L.A., what New York hip-hop was about and what it looked like and what they were wearing, which was very important.
Really? So it really was the sort of the one national venue for that subculture?
Absolutely. It was the social network of that culture. And so you can, that was the only way you can find out that there was even a scene in Houston.
I sit alone in my four-cornered room staring at candles.
When I interviewed Scarface from the Ghetto Boys, they were just excited because it put Houston on the map. It was a national platform for hip-hop then.
At night I can't sleep, I toss and turn, candlesticks in the dark, visions of bodies being burned. Four walls just staring at a nigga, I'm paranoid sleeping with my finger on the trigger. My mother's always stressing I ain't living right, but I ain't going out without a fight. See, every time my eyes close, I start sweating and blood starts coming out my nose.
When MTV finally, despite its ongoing disinclination to play rap, people there still didn't get it. You have this MTV executive named Patty Galluzzi,
mm-hmm.
who says that even her colleagues didn't quite get it. Let's listen to her.
She didn't understand what a word meant. Like in rap videos, they would call somebody a herb.
Right.
And she would go, oh, that's obviously a reference to drugs, to marijuana. And we'd go, no, Michelle, he's a nerd. If you're a herb, you're a nerd. If it was a drug reference, Michelle, it would be herb. And then there was something, I remember once she said, there's all these derogatory terms against homosexuals in this video.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, really? What are you talking about? She said, well, he's constantly calling this guy a homie.
In that clip, I should say that Michelle, is the woman being referred to, is the head of standards and the one woman standards and practices department. So in the earlier days of MTV playing hip hop, I think the artists were pretty much left alone. The budgets for rap videos were one-tenth what they were for rock videos.
What are some of the bands that maybe wouldn't have made it at all absent MTV?
I mean, in some ways, an entire genre of music, new wave. The Cars, Duran Duran, Thompson Twins, ABC, Human League, all these 1980s haircut bands, as they're called, would never have found an audience here because radio was never going to play them. I mean, even a U2 probably would have had a much harder time finding an audience without the support of MTV. And MTV was crazy about U2. They played them from the very beginning. And then hair metal also probably would have had, so Twisted Sister, Dee Snider in the book says, you know, we needed MTV, but MTV really needed us, talking about all the hair metal bands because they were visual. They were theatrical.
And it was all about theater, exactly. And scantily clad girls and the rest.
Yeah, and explosions. And, you know, if you think of like 70s American rock, like the Eagles, for example, the Eagles never had an MTV presence, really. And they just were kind of drab looking. You know, they wore what they wore. They wore blue jeans and shirts, and they sang songs, and they just wanted to stand there. And they were great musicians, and that's what they really cared about. I mean, they cared about girls, too, but they weren't about putting on a show. And MTV wanted – it was a visual medium. MTV wanted bands who put on shows. But those bands, you know, just became wildly successful. You know, the third tier, fourth tier hair metal bands became million sellers. The Bullet Boys, you know, bands who sounded like Motley Crue. On the other hand, there's a great, a great chapter in the book devoted to one video by Billy Squire, who was this hard rock artist. The video is called Rock Me Tonight. And it did actually ruin his career. This video killed Billy Squire's career. It was directed by Kenny Ortega, who
became a director.
Right. And it was a little bit fey. But this video had him kind of prancing in a New York City loft in silk pajamas, kind of skipping, I mean, I think literally skipping from one end of the loft to the other. But Billy Squire says, and his managers say, that this killed his career. He went from playing 12,000-seat arenas to a month later barely selling 4,000 tickets. Radio stopped playing him.
And when I read that, what I thought of is his base, these young white teenagers. Basically, I thought of Beavis and Butthead oh, man, Billy Squire sucks. And then, of course, MTV, now that we're talking about Beavis and Butthead, that's where they existed in the 90s, right at the end of what you call what was MTV's golden age in the mid-90s. And here you have a show of horrible caricatures of their audience slagging music videos as a program.
And doing so brilliantly.
And doing it absolutely brilliantly.
Is this Spinal Tap?
Tap is cool.
This isn't Spinal Tap. This sucks.
Yeah, this sucks.
Where'd these guys get their clothes?
They bought it at a rock and roll store at the mall.
Yeah.
Was that the last hurrah of the golden age?
Well, in some ways, it's the last hurrah. It might be the last hurrah of music videos because MTV still thought that we can do this kind of programming, but it has to center on music. And in their case, it has to center on music videos. So that was MTV's probably last time where they thought music videos were at the center of our programming. There were plenty of artists who hated Beavis and Butthead, whose videos got significant career-boosting airplay in 1986 or 7 or 8 or 9. And then 3 years later or 4 years later, they were being reamed by Beavis and Butthead. And there's a story of Kip Winger, who is this hair metal singer, calling up a program executive at MTV saying, how could you do, at midnight, saying, how could you do this to me? They're making fun of my video. Make it, take it off now.
Shut up.
You suck.
Stop, in the name of all that which does not suck.
What, was there anything surprising that you learned in all these hundreds of interviews?
You know, in a sweet sense, what I was surprised at was how fondly almost everybody who we spoke to looks back at this era, and they all mourn this kind of last gasp of the music monoculture. And I think they miss also the kind of wild, wild west part of, which is a kind of cliche quote that runs throughout the book, you know, the music videos of making these music videos. No artist likes to make music videos. It's, you know, it's just
ridiculous.
It's also against their constitution. They have to stand around for hours and hours and hours and just wait. And they realize this is a really good art form. And the directors that we talked to also really missed the idea of coming up with an idea for a video and then in 2 weeks being able to see your little movie on television all the time. That kind of immediacy. As directors, David Fincher, Michael Bay, they got their start making music videos.
Well, and speaking of that, I remember practically the moment, I guess in the 90s, when people started saying about movies in theaters, oh, it's the MTV effect, oh, this quick cutting. And certainly in action movies, that's true. Do you think it's true in general? Did MTV and these 3-minute forms of quick cutting transform cinema?
I think it probably more massively impacted the quote-unquote art form of television commercials, which really did become complete cops of the way that music videos look and feel. But I do think, yeah, I mean, I think Michael Bay's movies are big, expensive music videos where nothing has to really make sense as long as there's just something cool to look at.
And some music.
And some really loud music.
Cut to music.
Yeah.
One of the reasons it worked as this both cool, hip thing and this massive thing is because it started before there was an internet. In the digital age where everything is so fractured and everybody can go deep into their own little niche, can another equivalent cultural thing happen like MTV?
You're asking me. Probably not in the same way. But, you know, on the other hand, music videos are still the main reason why people go to YouTube.
Really?
Yeah. But, you know, video budgets have been cut. I interviewed plenty of people in the book who are producers who worked at record labels, let's say, who are in charge of making videos. And they say the budgets now are what they were in 1982. So they've come completely full circle because there is no MTV. There's no national platform where
telling you these are the 10 you should be caring about right now.
And, you know, everyone's going to watch them at the same time. When Guns N' Roses' Welcome to the Jungle premiered on MTV, or when Smells Like Teen Spirit very famously got its legs on MTV, everything changed. You know, and that's exaggerated, and it's not as true as it seems now. But still, there's enough truth in there to make it worth saying. It's hard to imagine there's that one place now that can produce that kind of change.
Craig Marks, thank you so much.
Thank you, Kurt.
Craig Marks is the co-author of I Want My MTV, which is now out in paperback. And here's what we want to know from you. What was your favorite music video from MTV's golden age? Mine is probably Smells Like Teen Spirit, although my guilty pleasure favorite was Robert Palmer's Addicted to Love. Tell us yours at studio360.org.